So as Marvin alluded to, what I'm going to speak on is slightly in a different context. Marvin describes some basic ideas that one would tend to use in using symbolic computation, and he did a nice job of going over some of the basic internal or built-in functions that Maple uses. And he did a nice job at describing the syntax that one would use to do this. My talk's going to sort of deviate a little bit on that. I'm not going to talk so much about the syntax as opposed to ideas. And as Marvin alluded to, it will be a little bit more sophisticated. However, just to sort of get you sort of in line with what I'm thinking, Marvin showed you some ideas behind finding moments. Of course, we all know that in the absence of the distribution function, or the density function, moments become a vital component. Now, I just wanted to outline, beyond the mean and variance, which we typically use in most applications, some other uses of moments, in particular higher order moments, why one would want to go beyond two, for example. So just some four quick points here about first four moments would typically be used in many statistical applications. So mean, variance, as well as the third and fourth moments, which give you some information relating to skewness and heavy-tailedness of the distribution. An excellent reference on the use of these first four moments in practical statistical applications is Kendall's and Stewart and Ord's book on Advanced Theory of Statistics. Of course, we know that the moments uniquely define the probability distribution as long as its moment-generating function exists. More importantly, for the use of high-order moments, if you don't know the distribution function and you want to use some sort of approximating procedure, the quality of your approximating distribution can be ascertained by computing and comparing a large number of moments to see how well you do to the exact. And I'll also mention that higher-order moments also have important uses in the study of tail behavior as well as asymptotic properties of the distribution. I won't get into all the details, but sometimes you need to go and look at the first 20, 40, even 60 moments to get a good feel for the asymptotics of a particular distribution. And what I'm going to focus on for my talk today is something that we're all familiar with, the duration of a busy period. So the first diagram there kind of gives you an indication of what I mean. So, for instance, we have periods where the server is busy and idle. And if we try to quantify this busy period, let's let B denote the random variable. And let's assume that it has Laplace-Dilchey's transform, or LST for short, which has this form. Okay, so that's so capital Phi B will represent the general busy period transform. And for what I want to consider, I want to look at the MG1 context. And in the MG1 theory, if we assume that we have an MG1 queue with arrival rate lambda, Poisson arrival rate, and a general service time distribution, call it S for the random variable, and suppose that it has LST little phi of S and moments which are denoted by mu k. So these are mu k is the kth moment of S. We all know, if you open any standard queuing text, for example, Kleinrock's book, the way you typically characterize the LST of this busy period is through a transform relationship. And so phi of B of S is this characterization here, which is quite famous. The one thing to notice here is that this is not explicit. Okay, you've got a phi B of S which appears here, and then within the arguments of the service time LST, you also have a phi B of S which appears here. Now, only in the case of exponential service time that I'm aware of can you actually identify the distribution for B exactly. It ends up being a Bessel-type distribution. Other than that, for any other choice of phi, it's difficult to get the distribution function in general. However, we will see that we can actually look at the moments of this quantity. The reason I want to look at this is because this has an important application in such things as priority models, vacation models, polling models. A related item that I'm not going to spend too much time on is something called the delay cycle transform. For example, if you open up Takagi's 1991 book on priority and vacation models, he deals with a structure for an LST which has a similar type of structure based on the busy period transform. So the length of a delay cycle, call it phi d of s, there's some sort of initial delay which would have LST capital phi I, and then you would have a similar type of structure in here. And in priority queues, this could be not only, this could often be recursive in the sense that if you want to analyze class 3's waiting time, it depends on what's happening in classes 2 and 1. So there's a recursiveness that could be built into this, as well as an implicitness, which is here. Yes? Yep. That's right. They're different functions. Yeah. If I choose D to be equal to B, which I could, I get equation 1. But if I want to let that initial delay be something other than a first service time, for example, it might be the delay that the server is spending attending to higher priority work before coming down to your class, then it's going to be something a little bit more general. Yeah, that's right. But structurally, they possess some similarity. Okay, so I'm not going to focus so much on this LST. I just thought I'd mention it because this is sort of the building block for what we want to, for more advanced priority as well as vacation models. Now, focusing only on the busy period, what I'm going to look at is three different methods for computing moments. Okay, I'm not here to say that one is better than the other. They actually all perform quite well. And I want to highlight a difference in terms of what Marvin presented. Marvin presented Laplace transforms where he actually gave an explicit form for the LST. Okay, so this is slightly different because we have an implicitness about it. So I want to look at three methods. And the first method I'm going to look at is a formula that Takash came up with, which actually gives us an explicit means of calculating, say, the kth moment of a busy period. A second method, which involves implicit differentiation and recursive evaluation. And then a third algorithm, which I've been involved with, which makes use of a pattern involving integer partitions. And again, this will become more clear as I progress through. So method number one, 40 years ago when Takash was doing his pioneering work in queuing, he actually came up with an explicit means of calculating the rth moment of the busy period. I think this appeared in the references are at the end, but it was in the Bell System Technical Journal in 1963. If you look at what's involved here, basically you have to take higher order derivatives of a rational function, okay, where we involve the service time LST in the denominator, as well as powers of it, take higher order derivatives of it, set s equal to 0, and multiply by this constant. The second method, which is a way that actually one might actually think of first going about trying to find moments. I'll point out that this method I'm going to highlight here was actually implemented in a paper by Takagi and Sakamati in the Mathematica Journal in 1996. So the code that I'm going to present is actually their code. Okay, they have the actual Mathematica code to implement this algorithm. The basic idea works like this. If we go back to our busy period LST, equation 1, imagine taking higher order derivatives of this thing on left-hand and right-hand side. So I show you what the first three derivatives look like. Okay, so here's the first, the second, and the third. And as you can see, it basically involves repeated use of the chain rule for differentiation. Okay. Let's take r equal to 2, for example. So if I explicitly solve for phi b2 of s, the second derivative, you can actually represent it in this fashion. So the second one depends upon the form of the first. Now, if we take this equation and evaluate at s equal to 0 and make the substitution when phi b1 of 0 is equal to simply minus the first moment of the busy period, which is well known, then substituting s equal to 0 with this, you will quickly obtain, well, maybe not quickly if you're doing it by hand, but you end up with the following form for the second moment. So we want to get Mathematica to iterate this algorithm. So I think what I'll do is let me just go to the code to actually do this. Okay, so let me just initialize the cells here. Okay, so method one. Yeah, I probably could. I might have to just... Is that better? Does that help? You want it bigger? I can make it bigger. Okay. Too big. Okay. Okay, so method one is based on Takashi's explicit formula. So again, I'm not going to concentrate so much on the syntax of this, but just to show you that what we get when we try to use it. So here is basically the definition of that function we have to take high-order derivatives of. So when we do this, when I ask it to spit out the first moment, for some reason the output doesn't come out too well. I thought there was a... magnification, maybe this will do it. So let me go back. That's a little better, right? Okay. So here I am evaluating the first two moments. Here's the third moment using Takashi's explicit formula. And there's the fourth moment. And I'll come back a little bit later and talk about even higher order moments in this. This is just to give you an idea of it working. Method two was the method based on implicit differentiation and then recursive evaluation. Okay, so this is the set of code you need to do that. And again, Marvin talked about a function called, what was the function in Maple where you defined s equal to 0 and then you wanted to go back to the original? So, unassigned, okay. There's a similar function called clear all in Mathematica. So method one, I had a function called busy, so I want to remove that definition and use method two to do it. Okay. And again, Mathematica, like Maple, also tends to produce output where you have minus signs in front. And basically, you'd want to write the denominator as 1 minus lambda mu 1 instead of minus 1 plus lambda mu 1. But you can get around that by making some user definitions. Or you can simply define 1 minus rho mu 1 to be equal to rho, and then resubstitute. Things like this you can actually make look better. For example, there's a function called apart, which will make it look a little nicer. Same thing here. Sometimes you have to apply it a few times to get it to work out nicely. I don't really have any sort of tips, but it just sort of comes through practice as to making it look the way you want it to look. it's finicky sometimes, these different simplify factor commands. But you can see that it's taking no time to do this. That's nice. Okay. Now, what I'm going to come back now and talk about is method 3, which, again, is a method that I'm closely linked to. Before doing that, let me just make a couple remarks about methods 1 and 2. Methods 1 and 2 both lend themselves readily to symbolic computation because it's typically the way you would first think of going about doing these things. It's direct, okay? It's pleasing in its simplicity because you're making use of standard functions. And the fact that we're getting these moments very quickly reflects the true power of this package. Okay? Now, what becomes an important consideration, especially for more advanced queuing models like priority systems and vacation models, where you have these types of LSTs, but there's a recursive nature as well as an implicit one, and in fact, some of the waiting time transforms can involve ratios of these types of functions, is if you have to go about computing it in a standard way like this, the derivatives quickly become tedious. So while methods 1 and 2 work quite well for the busy period, they're not terribly elegant or efficient, okay? And they don't reflect the actual deeper structure that's present, which I'm going to talk about now. And I'll make use of a term that was coined by Kendall in 1998. He's a big researcher in symbolic algebra. There's a term called intermediate expression swell, which methods 1 and 2 both demonstrate. And because it's basically the tendency for algorithms, naive algorithms, to generate huge expressions such as you would in the case of derivatives. But you really don't care about those expressions because what you want is the final result, which is nice and neat. But in order to get there, these naive algorithms have to generate these massive expressions, and then they simplify very nicely when you let, for example, s equal to 0. Okay? So the time-consuming part from the symbolic algebra point of view is the generation of these high derivatives. And if you can avoid it, then you'll make your algorithm much more efficient. So that's essentially what I'm going to talk about in method 3. Basically, the busy period LST is just an example of a function that has the form, it's a nested function. So I'm going to show you a bit of a more general approach in the sense that I could allow the argument S here. It's actually in bold, it's not coming out too well. But S could actually be a vector. In this case, we only have one argument, right? It's a single S. But these techniques apply to joint transforms. So that's the context that I'm going to present it in. So you're basically dealing with a function of the form g(h)(S). So this S, let me denote the components by SI, SJ, etc. For shorthand notation, dii and dii j will denote the differential operators, the derivative with respect to si, the second derivative with respect to si, and then sj. And if I want to refer to derivatives, partial derivatives of the h function, then I'll just use this notation here. And again, to suppress all the arguments, g sub r will just refer to the rth derivative of g without the actual argument here. Okay, so if I look at the first three derivatives of f, okay, with respect to I, then with respect to ij, and with respect to ijk, the pattern, you can actually pick up on a pattern that's happening here. And again, due to time, I'm just going to kind of go through this. What happens is you can see that there's partitions happening here. For example, this is if you're looking at the case of ijk, the elements in here actually involve partitions of the set ijk. So this is one way of partitioning ijk. Another one is to put the I and J together as a group and then the K, and then the I and K together and then the J as a singleton, and so forth. So it's not too hard to show inductively that what you end up getting is if you want to take the first R partial derivatives, you can actually represent it explicitly in this fashion here, where this notation basically refers to V sub R is the set I1 through IR. PVR is the full partition of this set, and I'll give you an example down here. The P basically refers to a member of the particular set of blocks. So this is a particular partition of V sub R, the group from here, that has K blocks associated with it. B is an arbitrary block, and P represents the length of a block. Okay, I'm kind of going through this quickly due to time, but just to give you an idea, in the case of third derivative, the V sub 3 would look like IJK, and the set of all partitions of V3 would be IJK, IJ, then K on its own, IK, then J on its own, and finally you can have them all separated out as singletons. Okay. In the scalar case, which is what we're really dealing with in the case of the Visi period, I is equal to J, which is equal to K, which means the three derivatives I showed you before can actually simplify. And you get, in the case of the third derivative, for example, these three terms, when I is equal to J is equal to K, they actually group together and give you a common element. So there's a 3 in front of you. Okay? Now, what happens in this case is that there's a one-to-one correspondence. The V3 becomes III when J is equal to K is equal to I. And the PV3, these three elements here are really just the same element. And they have a one-to-one correspondence with integer partitions. So the integer partition of 3 would be 3, then 2, 1, and then 1, 1, 1. Okay, so there's this correspondence between the partitions of V sub R and partitions of an ordinary integer R. So with these substitutions, you can actually, in the scalar case, represent the Rth derivative of F in this format. Okay. Now, for the Visi period LST, which is what we're interested in here, the F is equal to phi sub B, the G is equal to the service time LST, and the H is basically the argument H plus lambda minus lambda phi B of S. So equation 3 under these set of definitions would become this sort of thing here. Don't concentrate too much on the format. Basically, there's a delta ij here, which is the Kronecker delta, which we all know is equal to 1 if I is equal to j and 0 otherwise. Okay, but this is basically the rule that we're going to adapt. So if we evaluate that function at s equal to 0, you can actually come up with a way of computing the Rth moment of B through a method based on integer partitions. Okay, and this is basically the idea we're going to use here. Because it's an implicit LST, on the left-hand side, you're going to have an E of BR, and on the right-hand side, you're going to have an E of BR as well. So if you bring that one over to the other side and isolate for E of BR, you have partitions that are not truly the set of all partitions of the integer R. You want to remove the one that has just the Rth because you've brought it over to the left-hand side. So we want to sum this over all integer partitions of R except the Rth one. Okay? So it's this rule that we're going to implement in Mathematica to compute moments. The nice thing about this is with this rule, we never generate any derivative expressions, so there's no higher order derivatives, and all that's required to get moments, we need to specify the mu sub k, we need the coefficients, the c sub p's here, which basically counts how many partitions are the same like, and we need to generate integer partitions P sub R. And this is all very easily done in Mathematica, and I'll show you that right now. So here's method 3. So again, I'm going to clear my previous definition of the Visi period. Partitions is a built-in function in Mathematica. Okay? So when I ask it to, it'll spit out automatically the partitions of an integer I give it. And I can use a function called length to tell me how long each of these partitions are. So the 3 is of length 1, the 2, 1 is of length 2, and 1, 1, 1, of course, is of length 3. Just to show you how quickly it actually does this, the partitions of 8 come out fast. The function rest takes this set and removes the 8th one. Okay, so as you can see, I need to do that in my formula. I don't want this one here. I just want 7, 1, and the rest of them. And again, the map function will quickly map the length of all those. Again, if I want all partitions of the integer 14, the function timing will give me how long it takes Mathematica to generate the output. So that was quick. And as you can see, it's spitting out all partitions of the integer 14, and it took a hundredth of a second to do it. And again, I could do things like map the length. A built-in function in Mathematica is also the thing called set partitions. If I ask Mathematica to give me all the set partitions of IJK, as you can see, it spits out precisely the type of thing I had on my earlier slides. Sorry? Oh, that's a percentage sign. Basically, it's the same percentage sign, and it basically refers to the previous output, one line above. 1 minute? Okay. So if I ask it to do it for III, basically, Mathematica doesn't recognize, I don't want this repeated three times. Okay, these are really the same thing. And because I'm going to do this over a sum, if I ask it to sum across these partitions, because these vectors are of unequal length, it doesn't really know how to do it the way I want it to. So a nice thing in Mathematica is I can make a user definition here, and let me define a function called omega, and I'm going to give omega an attribute called orderless, which means I and II is the same as II and then I. Okay, so I'm going to apply that to the line previous, and basically what it did is it just takes this part of the, it applies this string, it removes it and makes it an omega, and since I'm applying a positive, a plus to it, it's also making this a positive. Okay, that's actually not doing what I want it to do. Okay, so let me come up to here. So that's line 65. Okay, there it is. And there's a built-in function in Mathematica called frequencies, which will give me how many times each of these strings appears. And here's that magic number 3, which appeared in the third derivative. If I just want those constants, I can actually call Mathematica to just omit the actual partition part and just give me the constants which appear, which are 131. Again, to demonstrate the speed with which this works, set partitions of a sevenfold I tuple come out very quickly. If I ask it to apply the omega function to it, it does so, and then frequencies gives me basically, again, the coefficients I need here to do it. And finally, coming now to actual busy period moments, if I implement these ideas into a busy period function here, I'm going to ask Mathematica to spit out the first 14 moments live. So there are the first 10. It's working on them. Okay, just finished 11. As we're doing that, I decided to just run a little test here on the length of time it takes to generate these formulas using all three methods. For all three methods, basically, they all perform reasonably similar for the first, say, 6 or 8 moments. Okay, I mean, 1.27 seconds is not that much different than, you know, half a second. Now, the first method, which is based on Takashi's formula, breaks down at the 11th moment. It actually just quits. It can't handle it anymore. For method 2, which is the implicit differentiation recursive, at the 18th moment, it just quits. It can't handle it. With method 3, based on integer partitions, it actually performs quite well. And even at the 20th moment, it takes 7,177 seconds, which is approximately 2 hours to generate the 20th moment. Now, this is done all symbolically. Now, if we had real numbers here, it would be much faster, okay, because we're not back substituting. Okay, so I think I'm going to stop there. Let me just revisit the page here. Yeah. I just want to see if it's finished yet. No, it's still running. So it's running on the last one, which is the 14th one I'm asking. But basically, I'll stop there due to time.